not important by its own, where BBN implies, BBN gives you the omega baryon, so you can deduce what the omega baryon, if you know omega matter from the CMB, for example, then you can deduce what, that you deduce that their baryons don't account for the whole matter. So they point, they point to a dark matter, non-baryonic matter in the universe. The lights dimmed? Okay. So I'll just continue from here.
Yeah.
I'm going to focus on weakly interacting massive particles in my talk. A WIMP is a theoretically well-motivated dark matter candidate for the following reason. The thermal relic abundance of a weak scale mass particle with weak scale annihilation cross-section is automatically consistent with observations. And we expect new physics at the weak scale due to the hierarchy problem in the standard model. So the mechanism which generates the weak scale could also generate the scales in the dark matter physics and give us the correct relic abundance. To look at it in more detail, let me show you a toy example. So here, let's say that dark matter interacts with standard model via a four fermion interaction, and this blob represents that four fermion interaction. So dark matter is, let's say, a Dirac fermion. And these are standard model fermionic fields. And the strength of this interaction is parameterized by this dimensionful coupling. So if I calculate the annihilation rate and I just plug in weak scale values for the masses and an order one number for the coupling, I get the annihilation rate, which is what I require for the relic abundance. So this first equation is just a statement of the WIMP miracle. But at the same time, if these standard model fermions are light quarks in particular, the same interaction will mediate scattering in direct detection experiments. And I can calculate the scattering, the WIMP nucleon scattering cross-section. And I find with the same coupling that the scattering cross-section is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude too large. So there's 2 points I want to emphasize in this slide. The first is that I really need an order one coupling with weak scale parameters in order to get the correct relic abundance. And I need a relative suppression of the direct detection rate in this scenario.
So pi is in the S tunnel or in the P
tunnel? I haven't told you yet. You know, the only assumption is that the same you know, four fermion coupling mediates both these interactions. So if that's not true, then this connection breaks. You know? Right, so I mean, well, much smaller, so there's an approximation of M chi over M phi sort of thing, and if it's, you don't need it to be very, very much smaller if you know, even if it's, since I'm doing an order of magnitude estimate, even if, let's say, the dark matter is half the mass, the dark matter mass is half the mediator mass, the corrections will be, there would be some order one corrections, but not order of magnitude corrections of this.
I mean, the mass of dark matter is higher than the mass of the mediator.
If it's what, sorry?
Than the mass of the mediator.
No, so, well, right. So, sure. So I'm assuming the dark matter is the lightest particle, is lighter than the mediator phi there. No, yeah, that's a good point. If in particular, if there's a light mediator mediating the interaction, then this is not true. I mean, in any case, I'm not justified in just calling this a blob anymore. I can't integrate out the phi and generate a four fermion interaction. So keeping that in mind, this is the interaction I want to focus on, which drives all of dark matter phenomenology. And now my chi's and standard model fields are just general, and they interact via some blob with the standard model. And this, since dark matter has to be stable in cosmological timescales, the simplest way to do that is to impose a Z2 symmetry, which implies that even number of dark matter fields come at any interaction, and so that prevents dark matter from decaying. So there's 2 dark matter fields here, and I've put an index alpha on the dark matter field, and I want to motivate that by resolving this blob. What can go inside this blob? So let me write down all renormalizable contact interactions with the standard model. By contact interaction, I mean that at the renormalizable level, dark matter actually comes and has a vertex in the Lagrangian with the standard model field. So you could have an interaction like this if all the four fields are bosonic. This kind of interaction arises in particular in scalar dark matter models. For example, dark matter could be a scalar singlet, and this could be the Higgs field, and this is a typical interaction. If the dark matter is a fermion and carries weak quantum numbers, then you could have an interaction with the Z boson, for example, and this arises in a variety of models as well. But the interaction that I want to focus on, which is really interesting from the flavor point of view, is this interaction. The interaction where the dark matter interacts with standard model matter fields with a contact interaction. Since these fields are charged, I need a charged particle in the dark sector to carry off the electromagnetic and the color charges, which I've called phi. Since flavor changing processes in standard model are very strongly constrained, if this coupling has to be order one, I must ensure that somehow flavor is this coupling preserves flavor approximately, and that implies that I should either have multiple copies of the mediator phi, or multiple copies of the dark matter chi. To put it in more detail, this is the standard model with three copies of the matter fields, and then the mediators are just come in one copy. And let's look at supersymmetry, for example, which just implies doubling of all these particles. And in typical Beano-like supersymmetric models, the dark matter lives here, somewhere here, in this box. In other words, dark matter is mediator-like in neutralino-Suzy models. But the possibility I'm going to consider here is that dark matter really sits here and is matter-like, not mediator-like. I will do that. So I haven't done that yet, but I will do that for simplicity. You could have phi also transform, phi and chi both transform another flavor group as well. That's a possibility as well. But I'm going to focus on the one where phi is a singlet and a flavor. And I should also point out that this already has a specific example in supersymmetric theories where neutrino is a dark matter, for example. So the neutrino dark matter models are one specific example of what I'm talking about. So it's almost a sort of binary question whether dark matter lives in the is like a mediator or is it like matter itself and comes in three copies. The phenomenology of the scenario depends very sensitively on which exact matter field I couple the dark matter with. For example, if the dark matter couples with quarks, the mediator phi carries color, which obviously has implications for hadron colliders. If it couples to leptons, then this mediator only carries electric charge.
How heavy is your phi?
I haven't told you yet, but it's going to be around weak scale. It depends on which. I mean, it depends on which. So I haven't told you yet.
That sort of power stuff is already ruled out the way.
Yeah. So yes. So depending upon which model you choose, it will have different phenomenology. For example, these would be much more constrained than the masses of phi in these models would be much more constrained than in these models. If I couple the dark matter to a doublet, then I have to assign SU2 quantum numbers to either chi or phi, which implies further coupling with the standard model gauge bosons. So in general, depending upon which coupling you choose, you have rich and distinct phenomenology in each case. The one I'm going to choose is in some sense the simplest one. I'm going to choose that the dark matter couples with right-handed leptons, and the dark matter is a standard model singlet and a Dirac fermion. And this is just chosen for concreteness. Depending upon what you choose, you'll get different viable models. Some would be ruled out, some not. And this this coupling lambda, alpha I, represents the coupling matrix of different dark matter flavors to different standard model fermions. And I next want to see what the structure of this lambda can be. If this lambda matrix is anarchic, then it will generically mediate flavor changing processes in the standard model. For example, mu to e gamma, and you could estimate it. And the estimate shows you that for weak scale phi mass, lambda has to be order 10 to the negative 3 if all couplings are anarchic. And remember my toy example where lambda really had to be order 1 in order to produce relic abundance. So this coupling by itself, an anarchic coupling cannot produce relic abundance of the dark matter. If I relax the relic abundance constraint, if the relic abundance is set by some other parameter, this coupling is enough for decay phi at collider time scale. So it could still give interesting collider phenomenology, but not it won't produce the correct relic abundance. What if I do want to produce the correct relic abundance with that coupling? In that case, I have to ensure that there's some alignment of this coupling with the standard model Yukawa matrices. And one way to do it is minimal flavor violation. So minimal flavor violation states that the flavor symmetries of the standard model are broken, even in the new physics, only by the Yukawa couplings. And the way to parameterize is to have a Yukawa, to promote the Yukawas to spurions transforming under the flavor symmetries. And the vacuum expectation values of these spurions break the flavor symmetry. And if I make the new interactions out of these spurions, I would have ensured that I'm in the minimal flavor violation regime, and then the flavor changing processes will be suppressed.
You could have multiple insertions of the Yukawas in principle, right?
Sorry?
You could have more than just one insertion of Yukawas.
You could have, yeah, so I've just worked with a leading order. You could have any number you want. Since Yukawas in lepton sectors are small, these would be presumably the largest. But yeah, right, you're right in principle, yeah. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to identify this alpha index with the I index, the right-handed lepton flavor of the dark of the standard model. And I'm going to make the lambda matrix out of the Yukawa spurions. And for phenomenology, two features of the mixing and the mass matrix are apparent. Since the Yukawas are small, the couplings of dark matter, different flavors of dark matter are approximately equal. And the masses are split by a small amount, especially in the first two generations.
So are you going to have very long-lived states because of a small splitting?
No, so, it depends on what you're splitting. I'll show you the spectrum, but I'm in no sense married to this formalism. It's just sort of motivating my spectrum, but you could choose whatever spectrum you want. And I'm not going to have a long-lived state, but you could.
Well, but if you impose MFV, then it's kind of fixed.
But I'm really only talking about MFV because I also want to use the same framework for quarks, but for leptons, MFV is sort of overkill. If I neglect neutrino masses, for example, then there's a U1 cubed, you know, each lepton number is individually conserved. And anything that preserves that is enough. I don't really need to use all of MFV. But what I'll say will be consistent with this. So I'll show you the spectrum in the next slide. So here's the model that I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk. I'm going to take the coupling to be actually proportional to the identity. This doesn't really affect phenomenology at all. Very much, and I'm going to choose the tau flavor of the tau flavor of the dark matter to be the physical dark matter, and it's split somewhat appreciably from the E and mu flavor, which have not been split at all. Chi would decay promptly to tau, to chi E would decay promptly to chi tau. There's no long-lived states, and this lambda is the only additional coupling that I add to the standard model. There's nothing else. This is, and this is some weak scale spectrum. This is it. So it's a very minimal model, and I want to explore what the phenomenology is. So this coupling really drives this interaction, and all the phenomenology in this famous picture follows from that additional coupling. So as you must have seen in many talks, the process going this way in this interaction tells you about the relic abundance and indirect detection signals. The process going this way denotes the scattering of nucleons in indirect detection experiments. And the process going this way denotes the fact that you can collide two standard model particles and produce your dark matter particles. And I'll talk about each of these in some detail. The relic abundance in this model is very simple. There's one T-channel annihilation process, and it's really close to the toy estimate that we did earlier. So for order one lambdas, you would get the correct relic abundance. If you had more couplings, there would be additional channels allowing for smaller lambdas. But in our model, we would have lambda to be order one. So once I fix the spectrum and ask for the correct relic abundance, this fixes my model. I have now a zero parameter model. It is what it is. I have no freedom whatsoever. You could of course extend it in different scenarios. The direct detection in this model is also interesting. It's since the dark matter doesn't talk to quarks directly, the only interaction it has with nucleons is generated at one loop via photon exchange. And this leads to three different kinds of scattering. The dark matter dipole can scatter off the nuclear dipole. The dark matter dipole can scatter off the nuclear charge. And the dark matter charge form factor can scatter off the nuclear charge as well. And I've stolen some of these formulas from Itai's paper. And related discussion can also be found in this paper, which was around the same time. And each of these cases are associated with their own nuclear form factor. These two scatterings are spin independent and enhanced by the charge of the nucleus. Finally, the recoil spectrum in this particular scattering is also interesting. It's enhanced at low recoil energies of the nucleus. So you see, this in general gives you, just by adding that one coupling, gives you more very interesting direct detection phenomenology. It turns out that in our model, the typical charge scattering is the dominant one. But in general, you could have all three. It depends on the nucleus a little bit and the experiment. So given that, I want to show you what the limits are from direct detection on this model. So this is the effective coupling. The lambda or m-phi. And the blue curve is the xenon 100 current bound on this coupling for different masses of dark matter. And everything above the blue region is ruled out. And the green dashed curve is the region where dark matter has the correct relic abundance. Since we have a one loop suppression of the WIMP nucleon scattering cross section, the estimate we did does not tell us that we are ruled out. This model is still alive. But notice that this scale is actually a linear scale, not a log scale like typically it's shown. So this is really, sorry, you have a question?
So would this model be different? I mean, because here you're coupling it to the right hand, to the SE2 singlet, right?
Right.
If you couple it to the SE2 doublet, is it different then? I mean, do you get more stringent?
So you'd have to do it because once you couple it to SE2 doublets, you have to tell me which particle carries the SE2 quantum numbers. That's what the dark matter does. Then there's a coupling with the Z,
yeah,
presumably, which changes the relic abundance calculation and the direct detection both. So if you only have my feeling is if you only had if you didn't mix the chi with some singlet to reduce the Z coupling, if it couples to Z with the weak strength, it will be ruled out by direct detection.
What
if
the phi carries that
signature? Yeah, that's, let me think about that. Yeah, I think if the phi carries SU2, you'd have to see what the neutral.
You'll still be ruled out, right? Because the
The 5 would start what?
The 5 would and then come up with, are you?
Well, that's still a little question, right?
Yeah, I'd have to think about that.
Another question of what the, sorry, the coupling to the electron, to through the photon?
Yeah.
What's the, so the EV coil dependence is, I mean, does this behave like the, yeah, even at very low recoil energies because it's a massless mediator? I guess what I'm asking is at low energies,
yeah,
what's the momentum dependence of that?
Oh, very good. So it depends on which scattering you're considering. For example, the charge scattering is actually a contact interaction. So the charge scattering actually doesn't depend upon the momentum dependence the recoil energy very, very strongly. It's the typical recoil. It's just, you know, any good old WIMP dark matter. That's the signature. The dipole charge scattering is enhanced because of the masslessness of the photon at low recoil energies. And then I've hidden all the muck in the faded out thing. So you'd have to do.
So the characteristic mass scale of the scattering cross section is the dark matter mass.
The characteristic mass scale
it's the
mediator mass. So if you imagine integrating out the mediator, it's the phi mass. Right. So it would be, I'm not sure.
So it seems like the weak interaction piece of phi couples to the W could be comparable and just differ by the alphas, right?
That's a good point. So you're saying there would be more interactions. I'm thinking there would be some order one tree level thing that you would that would kill you, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would.
Yeah.
You'd also have to tell
not
me.
Not only phi is a double.
Right. You'd also have to tell me what the neutral phi is doing, but presumably you can make it heavier and then not talk about it. The neutral component of the phi doublet.
Why do you worry about that? I mean, if both heavier than phi, then
yeah, exactly.
Phi
so if it is heavier, that in
yeah.
principle that neutral could also yeah. So yeah, I agree. So I don't think that would change by a huge amount. Maybe by order one. I hadn't thought about that. Okay, what I was pointing out is this is a linear scale, so this is really within reach of current ray detection experiments. And since I don't have any more handles, this is what it is. Then, in a year, this might be ruled out. So the indirect detection is also interesting and also boring in a sense. It's interesting because it only goes to taus directly. So whatever that is, but it's a WIMP, so the annihilation rate is sigma, you know, whatever the thermal relic annihilation rate is. So then whatever, sorry?
That's too low.
That's too low for any. It would give you, since it has been independent interactions, this would be stronger than scattering in the sun. So typically, so you mean ice cube, right?
But
you're implying the ice cube signal.
Not necessarily. For ice cube, I think your mass is a little too low because your threshold is like 500 GeV.
Yeah. For ice cube?
I think so.
No, it's 50 GeV.
I don't think it's 50.
We can look at it, but we did an analysis of just general WIMP candidates, and we found that ice cube is not sensitive to spin independent WIMPs because this bound from the direct detection experiment is stronger than ice cube. But for spin dependent captures, ice cube is sensitive. And I seem to remember that it's around 50 GeVs, and with deep core it's even less. But I could be wrong. Yeah. So for this model, ice cube would be less sensitive, although taus are a good source of neutrinos from the sun. So finally, I want to spend some time talking about the collider phenomenology of this model. And it's really a toy model.
Sure. I think the reason why the constraint, right, is constraint on producing the phi directly to a photon. So in lab, you do E plus E minus annihilation to a photon and phi.
And then You look at a monojet or mono, monophoton or something. Okay, I haven't looked at that. I would be surprised if it.
The dipole, you can basically get an effective dipole operator.
So we get an effective dipole operator plus.
Plus some charge radius.
Yeah, so plus some charge form factor.
So the scale of the dipole operator is essentially 1 over m5.
Yeah.
There's no additional coupling suppression.
I mean, apart from the weak.
So that's an additional. I think you're in danger of collider bound.
Really? Even with the loop factor?
Yeah, that's what. Because
oh,
it's.
Oh, no, I was saying, yeah, there's a loop factor suppression.
Yeah.
So maybe that's okay. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so it would be, I would be surprised at that, but it could, we haven't looked at that. So at the colliders, the phenomenology is also fixed since the whole model is fixed at this point. But here's the spectrum again, just to remind you. And since phi carries electric and weak charges, it's through these couplings to photons in Z that I'm going to pair produce them at colliders. But it's really, since it's a weak production, you can see that for hundreds of GV phi, it's really order 10 femtobond production cross section. So there's really not very many events that you produce. But phi decays into dark matter flavors with leptons. So it's a relatively clean signal. So you have some hope of finding it. But it's not going to be an early discovery by any means. By any means.
Sorry, it looks a lot like WW, right?
I'll show you why.
Okay.
I'll show you the backgrounds. So there's since the coupling of phi is universal, it decays almost equally to all three flavors of dark matter. And then there's three event topologies. There's this, which looks like WW in some sense, but then phi could also, so when phi decays directly to the dark matter, it escapes the detector as missing energy, and you see the tau. But the dark matter could decay into chi e or chi mu on one side, producing additional leptons, which when chi decays further to chi tau. And you could have this long decay on both sides, producing a lot of leptons and missing energy. And we found that the best thing to focus on are these long decay chains. Also, the way I studied this is using the Madgraph Pythia PGS chain, and the tools available to theorists are notoriously bad where taus are concerned. So I don't trust myself to do taus honestly. So I'm not even going to ask for taus. I'm just going to ask for the crudest, most conservative signal, 4 leptons. Plus missing transverse energy. So that's our signal. What are the backgrounds for that signal? So let me go over the dominant backgrounds. The biggest background is 4 leptons in the standard model, where each pair of leptons comes from a Z pole, or the Z could decay into tau leptons, which further decay leptonically, or I could have off-shell Z or photon production. The next biggest is TT bar and a lepton pair where the lepton pair comes from these processes, and the TT bar decays leptonically, fully leptonically. And then there's W plus W minus, L plus L minus, where the W decays leptonically.
From leptonic B decays?
Leptonic B decays.
Yeah.
And you just produce an isolated muon or something from the B decay.
Yeah.
So you BB bar, L plus L minus.
In just a simple TT bar, for example, you can have two leptonic B decays when they're isolated, or TT bar W.
I can't pull a estimate for that rate.
Yeah, I mean,
the top of my head.
Even if it's bigger than these, it's a 4 lepton channel of missing energy. I bet you're gonna be fine.
Okay, but yeah, okay. I never. So you think that there's an appreciable amount of Bs which just have an isolated muon? It could be.
It's not the dominant fraction, but it's certainly one of the backgrounds
right.
that people doing trilateral searches already have to worry about. And
I see. OK. Yeah, I'll look into that. I don't know an estimate of why I can ignore that safely here. So here's what it looks like. After I ask for 4 leptons with a certain amount of PT, the red region is the signal, and the dominant background is the 4 lepton, and the yellow and the green sort of seem to merge together in this color scheme, but those are the other 2 backgrounds. And the cuts we use are, we ask for 2 hard leptons with a certain amount of energy. We ask for a die-jet veto, where we veto events with 2 or more hard jets.
Does that not veto a lot of your die tau? Sometimes your taus will look like jets, right?
Right. I'll come to that. It doesn't in our model because of the spectrum, but yeah.
Oh, because it's a relatively soft.
It's a 3-body decay,
right.
I think.
Okay.
And then there's a Z veto. Where we veto events which have candidate leptons whose invariant mass reconstructed within some amount of the Z pole. And finally, we impose a small amount of missing energies. And I want to just quickly go over how each cut affects the background. So the hard leptons get rid of a lot of the 4 lepton background. And this is presumably getting rid of all the soft leptons being produced from a cheap photon in the detector, and also getting rid of Z to tau, which decay leptonically. The die-jet veto, you can't see it very well, gets rid of most of the TT bar background because the bottoms of the BB bars in that event typically are energetic, so they fail that veto. The Z veto, of course, kills almost all of the 4 lepton background. And it also kills the dominant portion of these 2 other backgrounds because the lepton pair was dominantly being produced by the Z. And finally, the missing energy kills the rest. And at the end, I'm left with 57 signal plus 14 background events at 100 inverse femtobarrel. So you don't.
Yes.
Sorry.
7 GeV to you, that's probably important for the same reason that it's that long, right?
It's important for which reason?
Because of your space spec, sort of your small mass splitting between the.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about the trigger, whether this, something like this can trigger.
We have two leptons. One of the cuts is 2 leptons of 50 GeV energy. So that.
Oh, okay.
So triggering.
So that's fine for now. I don't know if that'll be fine at 100 or something.
Is that right? Even 50
GeV?
Oh, 50.
50.
Yeah. Yes.
So
Sorry.
That should be always okay, right?
I'm asserting.
Yeah, so the triggering is not is not an issue, yeah. The only thing is, yeah, I think that sometimes remember these, let me not say something wrong. If everything went, so this is after PGS, right? So I don't know what happens at the PGS stage, but if everything goes to, if the event looks like what it should look like, I don't think we rely very strongly on this PT cut. Actually, let me take that back. I don't know. It might be crucial for the other 2 leptons, but the 2 most upstream guys are definitely the hardest.
So you're fine.
Yeah. Okay. So well, let me. So at 100 inverse femtobarrel, you can see this is more than 5 sigma discovery. You could also, you can probably also do better at a lower luminosity, but I haven't estimated the fakes and fakes in the stand wall, so those would presumably play a role. So this at 100 inverse femtobarrel, you should be able to see this is the thing. Now, given that we can actually find this at the LHC, the question I want to ask is: can we establish that this signal is from a flavored dark matter model? In other words, if we find a signal of n leptons plus missing energy, SUSY has that. Who would go to FDM as a probable hypothesis? So I want to compare our signal with a bunch of supersymmetric strawman models. By supersymmetry, I just mean the nomenclature of supersymmetry. Presumably supersymmetry can fake any signal you want. So I'm going to just consider, I'm going to keep the same particles as I had in FDM, except now I'm going to flip the flavor from the dark matter to the mediator. In other words, I have three sleptons, and chi is a neutralino, which is the LSP. If I ever hope to produce, reproduce the FDM signal, I need the NLSP in the spectrum as well to get cascade decays in multi-lepton signatures. So this is going to be my minimal spectrum, the sort of fake, which I would see whether it can fake the FDM signal or not. I get these two topologies. The first one is just in analogy with the FDM, except now I can produce any of the three mediators, the selectrons, muon, or the tau, and then it decays to chi prime, which then further decays to chi, producing many leptons and missing energy. And just to be broad, we have also allowed for the possibility of chi prime production directly, which then decays into chi with leptons. Since presumably kinematic observables can give you information about the splittings, the mass splittings between different particles, we keep the same splittings as in FDM. We just permute the hierarchies in these fake models in two or three interesting ways. So here's the goal. Given that I have a certain signal from FDM, is it possible at the LHC to distinguish these Strawman models from the FDM signal? And I claim that flavor and charge correlations in the final state leptons will help you do that. As a general point, I've shown these three topologies, and in blue dashed lines, I've shown the charge correlation between the final states. For example, you produce a 5+, it decays into a L plus and a chi in the FDM and so on. And with red solid lines, I've shown the flavor correlation between different final states. Since phi doesn't carry flavor, it can decay into whichever chi e or chi mu, whichever flavor it wants. So you see that in the FDM case, the flavor and charge correlations couple different particles in the decay chain, as opposed to the SUSY case where flavor and charge are both correlated between the same two particles in the final state. And this is really a feature of the FDM, that the flavor is now carried by the charge, the flavor is now carried by the neutral particle, not the charged particle. So this really is encapsulates the crucial feature of FDM. And if we can find a way to look at flavor and charge correlations, we would be in business.
But as you said at the beginning, you can also let the phi and the mediator be charged in the flavor group, then you would probably be closer to this system.
If the mediator is charged in the, yeah, so most of it, almost all of it I'm going to say here would apply to this scenario. And the discriminant you find depends very strongly on what your model is and what the SUSY model is. So in that sense, I can't declare victory that I found a generic thing that deals with all FDM models against all SUSY models. There would presumably be other kinds of, not these simple correlations, but other correlations in flavor in that scenario. There's other handles which I haven't exploited, which I would also point out later.
So for example, at the beginning of the talk, you said that your scenario of flavor dark matter is similar to this neutrino case.
Yeah.
So can you discriminate this neutrino?
With this, you can't, but neutrino is really, neutrino couples with a Z in certain ways. So neutrino is one example, and the flavor correlations in this neutrino model would be the FDM model, since it's an example of the FDM. So you can't do that, but neutrino is one model. Presumably, there's many handles to discriminate that against any other model. Yeah. So here I've plotted these different models in a flavor asymmetry and charge asymmetry space. And what I'm plotting is the flavor asymmetry and charge asymmetry of the two hardest leptons in the event. And why two hardest will become clear shortly. And asymmetry is defined as you know, same minus opposite over same plus opposite as before. And spectrum 1, 2, and 3 stand for these three fake spectra that I had. And A and B stand for these two topologies, either Slepton production or NLSP production. So first, let's look at FDM. The FDM spectrum looks like this. The phi is split much more than the splitting between the chi's. So typically, the hardest two leptons are the two most upstream leptons. So that's the reason to choose two hardest leptons, because they, in our spectra, they have the information of the two most upstream, the information about being two most upstream leptons. And you can see that the two most upstream leptons are charge anti-correlated, but flavor uncorrelated. And that explains where the FDM occupies, the point where the FDM lies in this chart. FDM has almost zero flavor asymmetry, but a large charge charge asymmetry. And the dashed curves are statistical 1 and 2 sigma curves at 100 inverse femtobonds.
So you need a lot of events to see this correlation.
Yeah, so at 100 inverse femtobonds, you see you can only do 2 sigma. Sorry?
So those curves are your sigmas.
Yes, it's a 1 sigma and 2 sigma curve. So you do need a lot of events. Bear in mind that nobody, like for example, for SUSY, nobody looks for SUSY from weak production, right? I mean, you typically, if you have an FDM, if you really wanted it to have collider signatures, you'd presumably add new stuff. I've just added one interaction. You'd presumably add new stuff with color and then have it decay into these guys. So as a minimal thing, yeah, this particular model, you would require a lot of data to tell it apart from these things. So if you look at the first fake spectrum, the spectrum is the same as in analogy with FDM. So the two hardest guys are again two most upstream, and these guys now are charge anti-correlated, but correlated, but also flavor correlated. If you produce slepton, if you produce a selectron, it decays into an electron always on both sides. So that's why this point is with a high flavor asymmetry and a high charge asymmetry. And the other case where you produce chi primes, these guys are neither flavor nor charge correlated. And hence they also occupy a different point in this space, which is closer to 0, 0 on this axis. So the point of this exercise is to not necessarily be quantitative, but to show that qualitatively, there is a distinction between the topology in these three cases. And FDM really occupies a qualitatively different point where these things are, the flavor and charge correlations in FDM are qualitatively different from these models.
So you should also have this sigma contour for other points.
Yeah, in principle, depending upon what kind of discrimination you're trying to do.
For the spectrum 2, it's not a point on this plot. It's also you need to have 2 sigma something.
I don't want to get into details of statistics, but I'm not sure if I should consider 2 sigma for both spectrum 2 and FDM. But in principle, the point I'm making is not that you can statistically significantly discriminate these models, but a more qualitative point that the central values lie in very different points. If you have enough data, if I go to 5 times as much data, all these uncertainties will shrink. So the point is more qualitative than.
Let these be our problems.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. Well said. So this kind of thing can in principle be a handle to distinguish these models from the standard, you know, Vim, neutralino kind of dark matter models. So let me conclude with that. The flavor dark matter model I've tried to show is a relatively simple possibility which hasn't been explored in detail in a model independent way. I've shown that a particular example of such a class of models, the tau FDM, is can be discovered at the LHC and also maybe distinguished from other neutralino dark matter models. We've been intentionally very crude and conservative in our analysis. For example, one could use kinematic variables like the hemisphere method to distinguish particles on different sides of the decay chain, particles from different decay chains. We've just done counting experiments. We've not plotted any distributions, or at least we've not plotted any distributions in the analysis. And in principle, the standard tools like edges, endpoints, MT2 for cascade decays would also apply in this case, and you could do those. But the thing that in my mind is the biggest thing that would improve this analysis is identification of taus. And one, because that's the thing that's qualitatively different, which each FDM event ends in a chi tau. So each FDM event exactly has one tau lepton on each side. So every FDM event will have exactly two tau leptons. That's not a feature of any of the other models of SUSY. So if you really have a robust handle on how often can you identify a tau, and you really can rely on that rate, this feature by itself is a really good discriminant between these models. We are working on this was one example in the lepton case, which is simpler at colliders, for example. But we're working on a quark flavor dark matter, which will have we hope to have similar interesting phenomenology. So stay tuned for that. Thank you. Sorry? Zoom in. Which one?
On your team. So for the quark flavor dark matter?
Yeah.
I think one big difference is do you really need a loop in that space?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's really interesting. It depends on what is exactly the, so let's say chi top is dark matter. In that case you could have multiple things. You could have the same loop process I talked about. So, okay, for zeroth order. If chi up is dark matter, there's a tree-level process, and you're probably dead in the same framework. You are dead, actually. We show that in the paper. If it's chi top, which is the dark matter, let's say, then you get a similar process to what I drew with one loop with the photon. You also get a two gluon exchange with the nucleus, which could dominate. So that estimate is tricky, but I think we convinced ourselves that the photon actually dominates in that case as well. So that's interesting. I mean, if you want to pursue some like a thermal relic kind of thing, then you have to make the heavy flavor guy the dark matter. The other case is ruled out on line one. So yeah, so it has the flavor phenomenology restricts you to different the flavor. I haven't talked about flavor at all because I'm not a flavor guy, but in principle, if you don't work in pure MFV, but you try to see what flavor observables there could be, this would have a really rich flavor phenomenology as well. This and especially the quark case. So we think it's an interesting class of models. And you should look at it more generally.
Is there a reason you focused on the tau of DM case rather than year view or
EM? So, I don't think there's any reason to do that. If there's E and mu, then you really have to zoom in on their mass difference. Not right now, I could just say they're both 90, and if they're 89 and 90, I don't care. But if really they're the lightest, then 89 versus 90 makes it, even if they're slightly split, it makes a difference. So you could have long-lived particles and things like that. But other than that, I think you would get some, yeah.
I think the collider signals are easier, because some of the time you get 6 leptons.
No, you don't. Oh, well, okay. If you split the E and U, yeah. So it depends. It depends on what you. But I think I think this was easier. But I don't think there's a reason to do this specifically.